Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Recently, there have been several high-profile incidents of gun violence in Prince George's County that have captured the attention of the public. And tonight, we're talking to Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski about them. But we're also discussing other public safety issues related to quality of life in the county. If you have a comment or a question for Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski, give me a call right now. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We invite you to tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Chief Stawinski, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Harold, as always, it's a pleasure.
Let me first talk about this incident that happened on Saturday, August 24th, Camp Springs. It was a birthday party, and there was an incident that ended up with gunshots fired, seven people wounded. This was a birthday party for a two-year-old. What is the update? Are there any arrests? Are you close to any arrests in this incident?
I was personally upset by the way these events unfolded, and you framed it perfectly. You have a birthday party for a two-year-old child, and the question is, how do people come to a place where at 9 o'clock at night at a birthday party for children, guns are introduced at any point to anything that's going on, let alone where six people get shot? What I can tell our community tonight is that one of the people who were shot actually ended up shooting themselves by accident. There was a couple of different guns involved in all of this. And then we have good investigative leads. We've worked diligently on this case since you saw me at the scene that night. And we are going to be working over the next few days. I hope to have additional information for my community on that particular case in the near future. But we haven't made any of that known yet, so we're going to have to keep that piece to ourselves until such time as we're able to announce action. But that will be in the near future. I can assure you and our community of that.
As a parent, even though my child is an adult, but there was a point when she was 2 years old. And help me to understand why just literally minutes after something like this happened, there had to be other parents there who couldn't just come right out and say, this is who did this. We know that. Why does it seem to be so difficult to find the culprit in this?
Some of the people who were seriously injured were people that we would look to provide us with that information. Mm-hmm. And so that's explainable by the fact that medical intervention outweighed the need to have a conversation with anybody at that point. Part of it was the working with the first responders with the fire department in order to get everybody assessed. But once that calms down and we get everybody back to investigations, more information was provided as the evening wore on. It wasn't immediate. And then at the end of that, what we know is that human eyewitnesses are the most unreliable form of testimony. So what we look to do is corroborate everything we know with forensic evidence to ascertain through different kinds of records. And again, just speaking generally, we're talking about phone records, we're talking about video logs, we're talking about LPRs and tags and different sorts of things that we have at our disposal to determine how people are moving through a set of circumstances and through a space. And that's the work that we always engage in. It's nothing particular to this case. But at the end of the day, Harold, we don't want to just rely on what somebody says happened. It's a great place to start. But then we're going to be able to present several points of evidence to conclusively demonstrate that that person was responsible for those actions. And that's the work that's been going on since.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you spoke about then and you just spoke about now is the availability of guns in the community. And this isn't a Prince George's County thing. We've heard D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser speak about this. We've heard Baltimore Mayor Jack Young speak about this, and we can go on and on and on. But what, from your perspective as a police chief, what can you do to kind of address this issue? Because this was a random thing. And and you can tell me if I'm wrong here, it was, you could almost say this was an isolated kind of crime, even though there are other kinds of gun crimes going on in the county.
What makes me angry is the fact that we're having that conversation around a child's birthday party. What makes me angry is what you alluded to with the lack of information being provided. And at the end of the day, what I worry about is that two-year-old. I worry about the kind of environment that they're being exposed to when these kinds of things are occurring around them, let alone the potential for physical injury. But what about the emotional trauma? And what's that going to end up being? You talk about leadership. So I've taken a strong stance on this, and I provided a deposition when Governor O'Malley was pursuing a reasonable set of laws around guns in the state of Maryland. I've been part of several conversations downtown speaking to the Senate Democrats about what we think are rational approaches forward. But let's be pragmatic also. What I want my community to know is that even if we were to get all those legislative things done, there's still so many damn guns out there as it is. That's not going to change the tide immediately. And so where I always turn to my community is, and this is where they've been so helpful. You know, we haven't reduced crime by almost 2/3 in Prince George's County because of our strategy and our tactics alone. It's the cooperation of the community. That's what Chief on the Go is about. That's what all of these community engagements are about. That's what community policing and community police officers is about. It's the information that we get. And we've had some incidents unfold in the last 2 years where our officers have had confrontations with people, right? And we unfortunately had to shoot some people. That's not what we want. But we got into those circumstances because we're being responsive to the community's concerns about people who are doing violence, carrying and displaying weapons, selling drugs in their communities, and trying to marginalize the residents, saying, well, I'm going to control this area, and I'm going to do what I want to do. And if you don't like it, I've got a gun here, and I'm going to intimidate you with it, or I'm going to use it. And so we take all those things seriously. That's why we've been successful, by being responsive to those things. But at the end of all of that conversation, there's so many out there. We need the community to continue to point us in the direction of where they are, and then rest assured that we will take those complaints seriously. We will act. And I had a tremendously good conversation with Robert Hur, the U.S. attorney, today. I've had good conversations with Aisha Braveboy as she has stepped into the role of our state's attorney. And I'm confident that the kind of cases that we build using the methods that I talked about, corroborating, so it's not this person says this and this person says this, but there's physical evidence to substantiate that, get good cases. And I'll go right back to where I was the night I was standing in front of those cameras. Can we all agree and then start a conversation that if you're carrying a gun in Prince George's County illegally, you're going to jail? And you don't have to shoot somebody. This notion that, well, they had it, but they didn't use it. Well, everybody who uses it eventually at some point had it, mm-hmm. right? And that's where we start turning the tide with respect to the guns that are already there.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski. Lines are open if you have a comment or a question for the chief. Again, at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. There was an incident, a horrible double murder in the county last week. The suspect, Aaron Wilson, is accused of shooting an Uber driver and a passenger. Now, during the press conference last week, detective said that he claimed to be on PCP, but during his first appearance, the assistant state's attorneys questioned whether or not that was true. From what you understand about this, what do you believe is the reason why he shot these two men, allegedly shot these two men, I should say?
Based on the circumstances as they've been described to me, based on that individual's demeanor, I think it's reasonable to conclude that he was having some sort of mental or emotional dissonance that led him to a place to conclude that shooting these people was something that he could do. Now, if that's got a chemical basis, that's what we were told by him, and so we're relying on his own utterance there. But bear in mind, you know, we'll continue to corroborate that. We will be looking to our friends in the prosecutorial realm to ask us for specific additional evidence we can offer for that. But the thing that I worry about at night when I go home, on behalf of my own family and my community, right? Everybody knows I'm not from someplace else, right? I take this very seriously and I take it personally. These are the things that keep you up at night, right? You talk about good policing strategy. You talk about preventing murders and dropping a murder rate, because you know that murders can occur as a result of robberies and strings of robberies going bad. You can talk about houses where illegal gambling. You can talk about murders as a result of the drug trade. You can talk about all those kinds of things. And when you attack those things, you can reduce that homicide rate. We've been very successful with that. The thing that you worry about are the things that you can't explain. Right. And then you get into a realm where there's a certain amount of folks who have chosen a life of crime. And the traditional way that we look at that, if you want to get into the criminology of the whole thing, is that people are averse to punishment for committing crime. But when you have a subculture that says, I do better in jail than I do on the street, I have a structured schedule, I have food, I have a warm place, I'm not out on the streets, those kind of things, sort of turns all of that on its head. And that's where I'm blessed to have an awful lot of very thoughtful people in leadership with me. And that's where we start looking outside of policing, right? That's what the Transforming Neighborhoods Initiative, those collaborations we have with the health department, those collaborations with social services, the elder care community, the youth care community. Dr. Golson's doing a great job over at schools, but having those sorts of connections with kids, the school resource officers, and then collaborating with 100 black men, collaborating with, and I talked to Bob Ross today at the NAACP. You know, what are the things we can be doing? Mr. Ross came to me today and said, look, we want to do another gun buyback. Let's do that. Because we got to get a gun out of some house where maybe one of those kids is exposed to it. So it's an incredibly complex, it's multifaceted. But to come back to where we started with this, the thing that keeps me up at night is the thing I can't begin to explain to you, and I know I can't explain to my community. So why are two people dead? It's pointless.
Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Raven calling from Virginia. Raven, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for having me. Really great to hear from community leadership. My question for this evening is, how is the police department using conscious behavior and conscious attitudes in our communities to disrupt what is oftentimes the over-penalization of black and brown men, right? So we're talking about violence, gun violence, we're talking about adverse communities, trauma, and I appreciate the thought about partnerships, but what does that really look like on the ground? What are police officers doing in community so that people who look like me and my brothers are not being sent to jail off of speculation or kind of a heightened fear.
Raven, let me make sure I understand. You talk about you're talking about cultural competency. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely.
Okay, Chief, please.
Raven, I don't know what you look like, and frankly, you know, that's not the lens through which we seek to serve our community. We seek to serve our community equally, regardless of whether we're talking about Langley Park, Dodge Park, or University Park, or College Park. What I will say is this: we've taken steps that I think set a benchmark, and we're going to come back to Dr. Chris Marsh from the University of Maryland. We're going to talk about the implicit bias training that we took the entire department through. You talk about cultural competency. I think we're already seeing dividends from that training. If you talk about where we were last year in terms of police confrontations with members of the community and where we are this year, we've seen a dramatic change in just 1 year. Now, I'm not going to attribute it entirely to that, but what I am saying is that we had the courage to start a conversation, and it's a difficult conversation to have in America right now, but we haven't stepped away from it. And we've said, you know, how you're going to be viewed as police officers, how you view the community, there's a nexus between those two things and how interactions can occur. And that's where Dr. Marsh, a doctor of sociology, has been very helpful to us. She's back again this year. We're continuing that conversation. It's not a one and done. And that speaks to our progressive and effective methods in Prince George's County. But at the same time, I will say this. I have made a deliberate choice almost 4 years ago now to lead this department and do so in a fashion that it will not just gain the support of the community, but gain their trust. The public trust, for me, is the bottom line for everything that we do. And we get to a place where the community can support us in our methods by hearing from the community what they believe is an appropriate approach.
But to her point, And you said, you know, whether it's Langley Park or wherever, but, you know, the population in Langley Park is different than the population in District Heights. And so shouldn't there be kind of a focus on understanding, for example, what is happening in Langley Park, District Heights, Upper Marlboro, and the like?
And I'm not suggesting that any of that puts us in a position to uniformly put programs together. So we partner with CASA. And we have co-signed on a loan from Justice in order to address issues particular to that community. But like I said, I talked to Mr. Ross today with NAACP, a gun buyback. That's going to be tailored to a different portion of the community. What college kids in College Park need and view is going to be a little bit different when it comes to, say, public protest. And you're not going to see that necessarily in Fort Washington. But that's where, again, the ongoing conversation, the chief on the go, going to people and seeking their opinion as opposed to hoping that it filters its way to you through some other mechanism, I think that's where we're successful. And we talk about, we just received an award for our youth programs from the National Law Enforcement Officers Museum for our Police Athletic League. So there's another way. We just had an event, I think it's about 2 weeks ago now, where we had everybody out. We had all these kids out. That was in conjunction with the County Executive Summer Youth Employment Program. So, again, there's that multidisciplinary approach. And those are the kinds of things that, going back to Raven's question, we're tailoring those particular approaches with community advocates on the ground. We're doing that through a structure with the Office of Human Resources. We're looking at ways of understanding things from the academic perspective so that we can, to Harold's point, be articulate and sophisticated in how we approach all of these communities. And at the end of that, I'm going to come back to where I started again, which is when people know you, you have the foundation for trust. And once you have that, then the dialogue, no matter how difficult, can be honest. And we can find out how we're doing things that may not be as effective, how we can be more effective. And at the end of that, we're going to be able to produce safety for this community in a way that people can not just acknowledge, but can support. And I think we have that support. I think that's demonstrated in the kind of results that we're getting day in and day out.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Yvonne, calling from Bowie. Yvonne, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Vera. Nice to chat with you. Hi, Chief. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Yvonne?
I'm good, thanks. I think you're doing a wonderful job.
Thank you, dear.
I really do. I have seen a great change in the county, and I just think you're doing a terrific job in a lot of different places, and you have a very hard job. It's not an easy job, so I'm not going to pound on you because I think you're doing a great job in the county. I always tell Mrs. Philana that, too. I think you're doing an excellent job.
Well, Yvonne, thank you so much for your phone call. Chief, you want to respond real quick? I'm about to go to a break.
I'm just going to say thanks because at the end of the day, that's what I mean when I say we have support from the community. And Yvonne, I think, alluded to it. We're not perfect, but we're doing our level best, and I think we demonstrate that legitimately and honestly.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski about law and order and other issues in Prince George's County. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810. Wayne from Annapolis, you're next after the break, and as always, we will continue to take your phone calls even after 7:30. And don't forget, the podcast will be on our website on WHUR.com after 8:30. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This conversation continues in just a few seconds on SiriusXM Channel 141.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Don't worry about it. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are talking with Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski about law and order issues in the county. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Wayne calling from Annapolis. Thanks for calling, Wayne. What's on your mind?
Hi there.
Hi.
Initial reaction to these kinds of conversations and this is really criminal justice, so it doesn't apply to this conversation and executive, Hank, but it's really the discussion around criminal justice and the mandatory sentences. Mandatory sentences aren't even discussed anymore. We're moving in the wrong direction with respect to that. But I do have a question for you. When I first tuned in, you said that crime was down some extremely high percentage. And I want to ask you, what has been, over the same time period, what has been the murder rate?
Well, all of those things have been reduced over the last 10 years. And we had, on average, between 125 and 150 homicides a year for the last 10 years and for years before that. As we sit here right now, last year we ended the year with 60. Right now I'm at 50. We've had numbers between 50 and 70 over the last several years. When we started down this road, we had 103 crimes on average every 24 hours, if you space that out across the year. And as of this morning, that number's been reduced to 36 crimes every 24 hours. So that's the magnitude of the reduction, but it's all of the things that I've alluded to. And I'm sorry, I'll let you go.
Wayne, real quick, finish your point.
What I'm curious about is you had a specific percentage decreasing crime, which really is a matter of police reports, right? It's really a matter of, in other words, here's the issue that I'm really bringing up and trying to get to the bottom of. In Baltimore, I was extremely intimately familiar with the following, I'll call it corruption. There was a huge decrease in taking police reports, i.e. crime reports, so that the statistics looked better. However, they were unable to decrease the number of homicides, because you can't kind of decrease. You can't fudge that number. So what I'm asking you is, a half an hour ago, you cited over a specific period the decrease percentage in crime. Apples to apples, what was the homicide rate over that same time period?
The reduction is slightly less, but it approximates it. So to give you a thumbnail and averaging it out, we've had about a 50 to 60% reduction in homicides, but a slightly larger reduction in overall crime. But it's also because we acknowledge the relationship between property crime and violent crime, and we structured strategies in order to address it. We also took a multidisciplinary approach to environmental factors. So again, that comes back to, I think, something Raven had alluded to, where being sophisticated with social services, education, opportunity, even infrastructure has been critical to our success in addressing the environmental factors that can lead people to hopelessness. And if you can change that environment, and then you can be thoughtful about how you approach these things from a strategic perspective in terms of crime, you can get good results. But we've seen the reduction in homicide, to your point, you know, and I hate to say it this way, but it's true. You can't do anything with a homicide number. But we've also, to be clear, had our crime numbers audited by academics from various institutions, and we just received a certificate from the Federal Bureau of Investigation indicating our high level of data competency, and they have allowed us to begin submitting the discrete information for incident-based reporting, or NIBR, as opposed to UCR, which is the future of policing. And to round all that out, we are successful because we have such good data, and we formulate our strategies based on the data, and we look beyond the homicide number to the underlying things that are occurring prior to that homicide. And that's where we put our efforts in order to see those sort of reductions. We can explain that methodology, But your point is absolutely correct. And that's why we've approached it the way we have.
Wayne, interesting question. Thank you so much. Before I go back to the phone lines, there are a couple of things that I definitely want to I want to get to. And one of them is a quality of life issue. The District of Columbia has dealt with this as well, or tried to. The ATV and the dirt bike issue. Is this an issue that is just something that we may have to live with painfully because it is so difficult to police?
I'll only speak about our experience in Prince George's County. And what we have done is we formulated some discrete strategies to discourage that sort of ridership. And the reasoning being that when you have videos of these individuals on sidewalks, they are deliberately endangering members of the public. And so we will engage them. We will not chase them. We did have an instance, and I'll be frank with my community, I'm always up front with it, where one officer was a little overzealous and ended up, you know, hitting a tree in a fence. But to be honest with you, that officer was disciplined. The explanation for why we engage with ATVs was provided back to that officer and to that group of individuals. But I would far rather have to discipline one officer for overacting as opposed to have my community ask me, Chief, you know, we see these guys out here running the streets and your officers aren't doing anything about it.
What's the difference between chasing and engaging?
So what we try to do is an escort technique where we're putting our cruisers in and amongst those ATVs. We're supporting that with aviation and we're trying to prevent traffic from crossing into the ATVs. We're also trying to prevent the ATVs from crossing onto sidewalks and we're trying to slow the whole process down. So we're moving at 15 or 20 miles per hour at the most. But we're also not going to allow cross traffic to jeopardize the ATV rider, but also become in an accident where some member of the community can be harmed. The difference between that and a pursuit is you get behind them and you match them, speed, turn, wherever they go, you go. And we're not going to do that kind of thing because, as I said before, we're not going to meet reckless behavior with reckless behavior. We do have stop sticks that we can deploy. We can deflate their tires safely. And we've released a video about that a couple years ago. So that's another tool that we have. And then the biggest, and again, I'm not from someplace else and I love my home, but my community sends me videos. They send me pictures. They send me all sorts of information about them. They all live in this house. They're down on the street. You can find them here every weekend. And then we go follow up on that. And you've seen us talk in the public about people we've charged. And I think you can do what you need to do. You can address those issues. But I also am going to be very respectful of my colleagues in Washington, D.C. It's a different environment, right? We have open roads. We have more of a suburban community than an urban community. So the challenges are different. The strategies have to be different. But that's been our experience, and it's been successful.
Let me go to Terry. Terry calling from Fort Washington. Thanks for calling, Terry. What's on your mind?
Hi. I wanted to first say thank you for accepting my call. I also want to tell the chief that I think that you are doing an excellent job. The community seemed to trust you. And one thing that I do know from personal experience is that, you know, if he says he's concerned about something or something makes, you know, him angry, because of just the response to the community, they believe that he is really concerned because of his actions. He shows that he is engaged in the community and he's not just the chief, but he's a person that, you know, just really is concerned and he cares about the community. But there's a point that as officers, you can only do so much. We as a community, we have to police our own neighborhoods sometimes. We know when crimes are committed, but because of codes of streets, we don't want to tell. We're fearful of retaliation. But we have to police our own children. It takes a village. And if we don't take care of our own communities, we can't expect the police to do but so much. The okay. other part of that is, you know, you have groups that come out and want to rally when there's a police-involved incident. But what about the incidents that happened within the neighborhood? Where are those groups then going out to say, we know that this person did that, and we are not going to tolerate that.
Okay.
We have to take responsibility for our own community.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for sharing with us, Chief. Quick comment.
Well,
about
Terry is sharing. Alluding to something that you spoke to, Harold, which goes back to that incident with the multiple people being shot. It's that stop snitching idea, somehow that's going to improve the community standard, and all that's going to do is allow people to continue to engage in violent behavior without consequence. But what I'm very proud of with respect to my community is that they've seen this department evolve. It's always been a very good police department in terms of getting crimes solved. It's been led by thoughtful people. We have had our challenges. We have made significant changes in the past 15 years after the consent decree and MOA. We've made a conscious decision to be the police department that Prince George's County deserves. And we still have work to do. But at the end of that, I take great comfort when I hear things like that from Terry, because what that tells me is that the community sees, this is important to me, so I'm going to take a moment if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I attend these conferences nationally. We're part of the major city chiefs, right? I have a lot of respect for my peers. I attend conferences internationally now with Interpol. I'm very privileged to be able to do these things. And what I see in that conversation is this sole focus on police legitimacy, right? What I will tell you, my experience in Prince George's County is that people want to have a police department that they view as legitimate. They want to have confidence that police department is going to go out and enforce the law fairly and partially and hold people who are committing crimes accountable. But once you achieve that legitimacy, what they want, what everybody wants in Langley Park, Dodge Park, College Park, University Park, right across the board, is they want to be safe. And that's the piece that you have to work even harder on, because that's where you have to take those community standards, what Melvin High taught me about a community standard, and then apply that and then use the strategies that you develop from the data to get the results for folks. And when Terry says to me, we've got to, all of us, and I'm not from someplace else, this is my home, we've all got a role in standing up and saying, look, enough's enough, right? And I know what's going on across the street with the ATVs. I know what's going on across the street with these parties. I know what's going on with the kid down here who I've known for 20 years, but he's selling dope on the street, and I know he's carrying a gun. And again, we've had confrontations with criminals. Being responsive to community standard concerns and community complaints about that kind of activity. And again, that's why I think we're being successful at the end of the day. If you don't have legitimacy in the eyes of the community to the point where they want to be safe, I don't think you can get these kind of results. But once you do, that's why, to me, the public trust is always the last thing before I make any decision, before I stand up in front of my community and say anything. What am I doing to serve the trust of this community, whether it's good or bad?
And to that issue, you did have a press conference, and this was not about crime. This was about something that was going on in house in the station house in Bowie, where there was some kind of incentive program. It was not illegal, you said, but you still stopped it. And how? Explain, first of all, what that was about briefly, and how do you gauge what is perhaps problematic versus innovative in order to motivate the rank and file?
Let me begin with this. The intent of the commanders who were responsible for that was not malicious. They sought no personal gain from it in any way. The reality is that a lot of policing occurs, and it's based on individual initiative, right? We operate as single officers in single cars, and we don't have a direct supervisor standing next to us as we go through our day, right? That's just the reality of policing. So when we get concerns, and we don't get them nearly as much as we used to, but still, once in a while, I saw three police officers sitting in the parking lot. They're not doing anything. I saw this officer over here, and I had a need, but nobody came for another 10 minutes. Sometimes those are people who are off. They're doing different things. They have a particular assignment. Sometimes those are officers who are just not moving at that particular moment. And so what their intent was to, during the course of that day, to keep those officers motivated to continue to enforce the law. Not to find reasons, but to merely address the things that are apparent. And at the end of the day, there's traffic. There's people congregating in places they ought not to be. There's complaints from citizens. There's certain parts of our neighborhoods where houses have people congregating, and go and address those things, right? And be productive in that day. Where it ran afoul of what I believe to be an appropriate incentive is that people were getting something for not doing anything, right? Now, what we have done to achieve some of these results is we don't have enough officers, right, in terms of being able to do everything with people on an eight-hour day. We've had to expand our capacity by using overtime. It's our strategic overtime. I call it extraordinary efforting. And we've had the support of the council. We've had the support of our, and again, she's been fabulous. Angela, also Brooks, has taken the whole concept of engagement and meaningful public safety to a new level based on her experience as a state's attorney, now as our county executive. So we use overtime in order to achieve those things. And so an officer will work their shift and they'll sign up for our flying squad or one of our other initiatives that I talked about earlier. And that's an appropriate use of their time. But what we expect them to do is be engaged and be productive. What this was saying was not that you would be engaged and productive during hours, but that if you were more productive amongst your peers, then you would get a day off, essentially, this comp time. And what we know, and this is something that we struggle with from an organizational dynamic, is that younger officers tend to prefer to have time off than to have pay. You know, that's how our culture is evolving. And so I think they were trying to be innovative. I think they were trying to speak to those younger officers where they are in terms of having time off. But where I found the issue was where they were getting something for something they hadn't done. If they had worked extra hours and were compensated for it, that would be fine. But to get a day off for hours you didn't actually log in, that's the challenge. Now, I don't believe anything malicious was done, and I'll be clear with my community. We looked through every complaint that we got during the period of time that this program was running for 6 months, and we found nothing we felt to be of a nexus to this. We also went through every overtime slip during that period of time, and we found no similar programs within the department. Because the facts were not in dispute, we were able to resolve that matter fairly quickly. And then, once again, because I had a concern about how the public might view this, I went and I called the press conference and I said, look, folks, here it is, and here's what we've done about it, because your trust is important to me.
Well, here's my question. Is there a quota system for ticket writing?
There is no
or
quota.
Arrests?
There is no quota. There never has been a quota in terms of my administration, in terms of the administrations that I have served, okay? And my career now spans 27 years. So there's never been a quota. What this was trying to do was to incentivize making those traffic stops at the end of your shift as opposed to standing back and allowing the next oncoming shift to handle those sort of things, to remain engaged. Because at the end of the day, coming back to the questions that we were asked earlier, you don't get these kinds of results in terms of prevention of crime unless you're engaging. And that doesn't have to be, and I think the most responsible commander put it into words, saying, you know, it doesn't mean you have to give people traffic tickets. It doesn't mean you have to arrest people. But it's about engaging people, stopping people and pointing out that their headlights aren't working, stopping people and just having a conversation about their driving behavior, stopping people and questioning about them. You know, do you understand that this is private property and people might not want you on their private property at 2 o'clock in the morning? Having those kinds of contacts. But what I see with my community, and I stop people still on traffic, is that there's this misperception that it's a one-way conversation. And really what it's about is another opportunity for dialogue. And the thing that I think we try to do in Prince George's County, and that comes back to implicit bias training, it comes back to the good work being done in our training academy, is to be sophisticated in how we interact with people. Right. So it's not about you broke a law, so you have to get a ticket because you're a wrongdoer. Sometimes it's just about having a conversation and saying, look, you know, I know you've got a lot going on in your life. Right. But I need you to stop doing this. And I know I'm on radio, so I'm going to tell everybody that I'm pointing to my smartphone. Put that thing down. Or as I like to say, don't even set it down. Put it in your glove box until you get where you're going, because it's too big of a temptation in a lot of cases. And people appreciate that because you've taken the time to have that conversation. That doesn't mean that they all have to get tickets. That doesn't mean that they have to be arrested. But it's about having that conversation. And the reality is, and this is where I'll end it, I'll go back to you, the vast majority of the almost million people that live in Prince George's County will never have a professional interaction with a police officer. They'll go their whole lives. They won't call us because they've been the victim of a crime, less likely every day because of the kind of results that we're getting. They won't be impacted by a violent crime, right? And so after that population where it's unlikely they'll ever meet with us professionally, you might see us in a 7-Eleven, you might talk to us in a grocery store, something like that. Come to Chief on the go, you can talk to me. It's traffic stops. The largest population of people we're going to interact with is traffic stops. And that's why it's so important that every time those officers make those traffic stops, right, assess that person for who they are. I had a terrific FTO when I was a young officer. And his point
field
was always...
Officer.
Field training officer.
Yeah,
yes. And his point was always, look, the vast majority of people you're going to stop, they're not wrongdoers. They're trying to get to work. They're trying to get their kids to school. They're trying to do good things, right? Very seldom do you have somebody transporting guns and drugs in their car. So you treat them the way you'd want to be treated. And you meet them where they are. And sometimes the violation is so egregious. But take that opportunity so that when that person leaves that traffic stop, they don't now see every police officer, every trooper, every agent, every sheriff that they run into as a bad guy because of how the one time they actually met with a police officer, they have this overwhelming negative impression because of how that traffic stop, which lasts for 10 minutes, went.
And speaking of traffic, and this brings me to something that is really germane to what has happened today. Maryland schools are back in session. And we have seen nationally an uptick in people who, for whatever reason, just decide to ignore school bus stop
yes.
signs
yep.
and the like. We've had children killed. We've had parents killed. What is your plan to address that? I mean, we've got in Prince George's County more than 130,000 students. We have 206 schools, buses everywhere. The police can't be everywhere, but how do you address that? That to me is one of the most troubling things about people driving.
Well, first of all, I want to compliment Dr. Golson again and her good work in understanding all of the complexities of our school system, which includes the buses that transport our children to school day in and day out. What we're currently doing, and I have a lot of silly names for my initiatives, so that's just something within the culture, but we're in the middle of something called Operation Shortstop. Operation Shortstop started about a month ago. The idea is, you know, younger people, kids going to school, they're out there on the streets, they're walking, they're coming off of buses, and we want to stop reckless driving. And so the data points us to those places where those buses are most likely to be, where we're going to have opportunities near school zones to intercept those kind of driving behaviors and to slow people down. So we're using data to get to those sorts of things. But last week, I was in California. I had the great opportunity to go to the Governor's Highway Safety Association conference. It was tremendously informative. One of the issues that I came away with that I'm concerned about on behalf of our community is poly drug use. And my message...
Poly drug use?
My message to the community is this, Harold. There's this... People will go out and have dinner and they'll have a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go out and have a beer. They'll get in their car and they'll drive, right? I don't advise anybody to drink anything and then drive or at least wait an hour or two after you've had a meal. You're going to be fine. There's also this misperception that smoking a little bit of marijuana is not going to make you intoxicated. But what we're seeing in terms of traffic safety is this poly drug use phenomenon where 1+1 is not equal to 2. A little bit of alcohol and a little bit of marijuana are having a synergistic effect. And so 1+1 equals 3, and people are more impaired than they realize when they get behind that wheel. So looking at that, looking at some of these opportunities with respect to photo enforcement, which depending on what particular issue we're talking about, there's value, but it's not a panacea by any stretch of the imagination. And then, again, that's where the school system, and I want to talk about Monica Golson, I want to talk about Barry Stanton, I want to talk about Archie O'Neill, the people leading school security, and the superintendent, her own self, messaging to these young people, allowing us to be part of that messaging to young people, because it comes something a little bit back to what Terry said. You know, the young people have to understand that you're in the roadway, you're getting onto a bus, you're getting off of a bus. Don't assume that because you can see that car can see you, right? And then trying really hard to take advantage of the opportunities to communicate to those young people about the value and the importance of those conscious efforts to be safe when you're transiting the roadways, hoping that translates to biking behavior, scooter behavior, and eventually driving behavior. And then lastly, and I had this conversation on my way over here with Terry Bellamy, who leads Department of Public Works and Transportation. Terry called me because of a pedestrian fatality we had over the weekend. Now, that's a separate set of circumstances, but that's where I've got professionals in public works like Terry looking at these things from an engineering perspective, a crosswalk perspective, a signalization perspective. And so we take these fatal collisions, but it doesn't just stop with investigating that. It goes to this engineering piece. And to to your overall question, the answer to this is to build better, safer roads with the appropriate capacity for the traffic, and then being respectful of people who choose to walk, bike, ride scooters, and find a way to incorporate those things so that good engineering will prevent those collisions in the first place.
Let me grab Daryl. He's been waiting patiently. Daryl calling from Fort Washington. Quickly, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing? Hey, Chief, how you doing?
Good, Daryl. I know. It's Daryl Harrison, isn't it?
Yeah, Daryl Harrison. How you doing? You know I had to call in.
I'm glad you did.
You speaking. Yeah, I just wanted to, speak about the point that, me and Chief had gained a personal relationship. My son, Daryl Harrison II, was killed in American Best Wings on May the 5th of 2016. And at this time, after meeting Chief, he seen that I produced at my own foundation called Daryl Harrison II Crying Victim Foundation. And he had been very supportive of me. I do my own live stream radio show on Vox Wave TV. And I have always gave the Chief about doing a great job. When we had a lot of killing going on a year ago, he put out 12-hour shifts. He made the community safe. My son killer was found within 30 days later in Atlanta, Georgia. That's how much his detective worked on my case. So me working beside Chief, I have his personal number. I can call him now. I'm a victim. And now he had made this personal relationship with me where he comes on my radio show. He came on my radio show with Chief Peter Newsom. And I'm thankful to have him as the chief in D.C. because even now where our relationship at, that when family contacts me about any murder of their child in D.C. in Prince George's, I'm able to call Hank and say, look, this is the situation I got going on with the family. And right away, he takes care of this for me, for my foundation.
Well, Daryl, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Chief, real quick, you want to...
Daryl, I love you. Darryl, thank you. And he's been a tremendous partner. But again, that's about the community organizing. And he's a survivor of a horrific and pointless murder. But he's putting his energy into making a difference so that other people don't have to share his experience.
Daryl, thank you so much. I only have a few minutes left. Looking forward, the summer is over.
It's hard to believe.
Yeah, it is. It really is. For the most part, anyway. Coming up for the fall, and when you look towards the end of the year, what new initiatives, what plans, what thoughts do you have for improving quality of life and public safety in the county?
So we set out a few years ago to address one of three things with every strategy that we implement. And it's always two of these three. It's either violent crime, property crime, or highway safety. I'm very fortunate. Next week, I will be sworn in as the president of the Maryland Chiefs of Police Association. So I'll be leading that organization. And part of my platform will be really focused on bringing back vehicle enforcement and traffic safety. Because a lot of policing, I think we've become too focused on the violent crime. It's something that impacts people in a devastating way. My heart goes out to these families. Daryl just called in quite by coincidence. But there's also a lot of people out there who are negatively impacted by the horrific incidents that are occurring on our roadways. And I think it's unfortunate that sometimes they don't get the same concern and empathy as some of the victims of violent crime. And I'm not trying to say one is worse than the other, but I am saying that they both are communities in need. And so I want to look to next year to continue to engage in traffic and highway safety. I want to continue to engage in innovative approaches that involve engineering and expanding capacity and making sure that people who walk, people who bike, people on scooters have access, but they're also doing it in a respectful manner of cars. Cars are understanding that they have access to the road as well. And then beyond that, it's all about, for me, the biggest issue that we can continue to make tremendous progress on, and it's property crime, right? Again, the reality is that there's nothing that can reduce the peace of mind of a community faster than coming home and finding your home has been violated, or coming out and finding your car has been broken into, or worse yet, your car is gone, right? And so those things are not going to escape our attention. And right now, as we are in September of 2019, we've already started our conversations about what our initiatives are going to be in December, leading through the holidays, January, February, and March. The whole first quarter of 2020 is being planned right now.
Okay. Chief Hank Stawinski, Prince George's County, thank you for coming in again. I appreciate your conversation and your information. And good luck, and please stay safe.
No, thank you, and thanks to my community. And I will always be here. It's always a privilege to be with you.
That is the Daily Drum on SXM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, September 3rd. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.